Hello.
Hello.
How on earth do you follow Soldier Boy? That's what I want to know. So my name is Paul Hammond, and I'm going to be moderating today's panel about collaboration in teams between developers and designers. I'm going to start by adding a bit of context about what we're going to be talking about here, because the description wasn't that clear. But before that, I'm going to start talking about me. So I'm a software engineer at Flickr. It's a small photo sharing website some of you may have heard of. If you haven't, the website address is www.flickr.com. It's Flickr without the E. During the day, I get paid to write PHP and MySQL. And in the evening, I mess around with Ruby and JavaScript and Python and so on. In short, I'm a geek. But when I come to a conference like South by Southwest, the sessions that I enjoy the most are the ones about design and the ones about business and the ones about the things that I don't do for a day job. And that's one of the special things about this conference, is that somehow we manage to get all these different groups of people together and we talk and we learn from each other. And I think about all the great projects I've worked on, and that's been true of the teams that I've worked with there. A really great example of that is the redesign of the BBC homepage that I worked on in November 2002. For those of you who don't remember, it was the one that changed colour a lot. And the people that I worked with on that project, it was this really great tight-knit team of developers, designers, editorial staff, some management, some usability people. And we worked really, really well together. And it's, 6 years since I worked on that project? 5 years? And I still look back on it, and I'm still really happy with the results, and I'm really happy with the work that we did there. And that's what I want to talk about today, is those kind of projects where you get a great team, you get great people together, and you get into a flow state. Not every project is like that. Some projects leave you feeling miserable. Some projects, the results are done, and you think to yourself, was that really worth it? You know, you get overruled. You don't feel like you're working together well as a team. So what we want to talk about, really, is about designers and developers working well together. This slide's a little bit misleading, because it's not really designers and developers. There are many, many different types of designers. There are information architects, there are usability people, there are visual designers, there are interaction designers, and there are many, many different types of developers. You get architecture people, you get database people, JavaScript people, server-side people, but these are the best terms that we got, and so they're the terms that I'm sticking with. And so for me, it's the collaboration between those people that is the most interesting. So I asked some of the people I respect in the industry to come up on stage and talk with me. I'm still surprised that they all said yes. We've got a mix of developers and designers. And we're going to start by them each talking about what they do, how they work, and then we're going to launch straight into some Q&A. I'm going to start by doing some questions, and then we're hoping to open it up to the floor to the rest of you so that you can ask your questions. So moving straight over to Matt.
Hello there. Hello. Hi, I'm Matt Bidolf. I'm the CTO at Doppler, the social network for frequent travelers. And there on the screen behind me is where you all came from today. We got people traveling into Austin from all over the world. It's suddenly the center of the universe. And I see this big eruption of travel in my database all centered on this town. But I'm not here so much to talk about the site itself today as the process that we go through when we make this. We're a very small team. There are four of us building it in any capacity, not even all of us full-time on the product yet. We're only a year old since the first line of code and the first sketch on a whiteboard. But I love the way that we work together. It's a much more productive and collaborative environment than I've ever worked with before. And it certainly comes a lot from the skills of the individuals involved and their vast and fantastic experience and amazing good looks. But it's also about the way that we work together. So I'm going to focus on one individual in particular immediately, and that's Mr. Matt Jones. Some of you may know him or have seen him around this conference. So Matt's got this long experience also at the BBC, and he spent a lot of time at Nokia, the kind of company where you can make big products and change the world, but the lead times can be very long. Whereas at Doppler, we really prefer to kind of keep things moving, ship several times a day if we can. And at a talk recently at the Interaction Design Conference in Savannah, Matt Jones said he liked to refer to me as his technical wife. And I'm very proud to be his technical wife. And we have a fruitful relationship. And I think this is a great metaphor. Is I think when a technical wife and a design husband love each other very much, they have a special meeting, and 9 months later, a website is born. So this is how we work. So, what we love to do is to keep all our new features live on the site as early as possible, to work with the sort of clay of data just as much as the clay of pixels when we're bringing features together. This is a screen from one of our bits of our back end. We can tag any user. We just go into our sort of control panel here, and all the features that we're working on at any one time are available on this sort of control panel. So I can go. So we're about to launch a carbon calculator, so you can see how awful it is for the planet that you all came here. And I can switch on that feature for anyone. Like I could be sitting in a corridor with someone and here at this conference and go, right, okay, you get that feature right now. But what it also means is that you can sort of live with the features while they're being formed. So one of the things we're working on is being able to integrate with Flickr Places, which is obviously, it being geo-based, fits in perfectly with Doppler and our travel outlook. But we haven't sort of worked out yet how to fit it into the UI. We've done the technical work. And so we're sort of providing, you know, that side of the clay for Matt and also Boris Anthony to work with. But we've dumped it into the interface in a way that's slightly ugly, but means we can live with it and start to feel, okay, our city pages can have pictures of places on them. What's it going to look like? So we're actually testing new features live. And this is something that Boris Anthony, who works on sort of straddling the design and the client-side coding, likes to call sculpting, not painting. So we're trying to enable that for so that the designers and the developers can work together on new features and sort of share a language and not just work in the very old-fashioned waterfall sense of pre-prepared designs and then going off into implementation. So I'm going to pass over now to Simon Willison to talk more about how you sculpt in data in that way.
Okay. Hi, I'm Simon Willison, and... Oh, gosh, I don't get to see the slides. There you go. So I'm kind of a web technology enthusiast. I started out as a server-side developer. I picked up sort of CSS and JavaScript and things about 4 years ago, and for a few years those were the most exciting thing in the world. I've since sort of switched back in the opposite direction, but I'm always looking at the sort of technological side of the whole spectrum of technology that we use to build the web. But my current specialities are sort of, I'm freelance, I'm a consultant on things like JavaScript, OpenID, and Django, the Python web framework, which I'll be talking about a bit more in a moment. Previous experience, I worked at Yahoo for a year on a very small team. It was myself, Paul here, and Tom Coates doing sort of rapid prototyping stuff. And before that, I worked on another small team at a local newspaper in the middle of Kansas, which was a surprisingly exciting experience. So that newspaper, and that's probably the most relevant to this panel. So that newspaper was the Lawrence Journal World. It's a tiny paper, sort of 10,000 circulation when I joined them in late 2003. And so despite having like hardly anyone buying the paper, they had a fantastic set of websites, sort of award-winning, nationally acclaimed websites. And all of these sites were being built by, at the time that I joined, two developers, including myself, and one designer who was luckily a dab hand with HTML and CSS, and then a whole bunch of editorial staff. And the problem we had there is that we've got a very, very small team, but we're expected to produce websites on more sort of journalism, more of a journalism schedule than a regular development schedule. So a story would come up which had some kind of application that would make sense to go with that story, a way of exploring the voting results from an election, for example. And you'd have literally 2 days to go from sort of concept of this part of the site to having it live with real data and real people looking at it. So what came out of that was what's now released as open source, the Django web framework for very rapidly building content-oriented websites. And an interesting thing about Django that's relevant to the panel is the workflow that it supports when you're doing this kind of work. So with a newspaper, the sites that you build are very data, they're very dependent on their data. You're talking about things like obituaries and marriage proposals and stories and photo galleries, and these are all things which have quite a clear set of information that's going to be displayed. So when working with Django, the way we worked is we start with the data model. We'll start by saying, well, we're building the obituary section of the website. It's pretty clear that there's going to be the name of the person who died, the date of birth, sort of other information about them, where the funeral's being held. And so from very early on, it's possible to design this data model. I've used the word design there because I believe that actual things like data model design, it's still a design activity. I would never consider myself a visual designer, but a lot of what I do relates to the core design activity of solving problems within a set of constraints. And so what Django allowed us to do was define that data model early on and then create a full-fledged administration interface for the content producers to start adding data while we were still developing the rest of the site. And this allows for a parallel workflow, a sort of collaborative workflow where the data starts being entered straight away. Then the developers can work on the interesting part of the site, which is the stuff that people actually see, the sort of public-facing pages. Knock out some sort of stub templates using the Django template language, which is designed to then be flipped over the wall to the designers. The designers get input right at the start on what the site's going to be, and then a few hours later, they've got a set of very simple templates that they can start fleshing out. And this whole process is extremely efficient for a certain category of sites because everyone's doing stuff at the same time. There's a lot of parallelism. But it doesn't work. It only works for sites that are defined by the data in them. The state, I'll just show, there's a screenshot of this administrative interface that saves us so much time and enables this workflow. But the problem I have today is that now most of the work that I'm doing is applications. And with applications, the underlying data is a very small part of what's going on. Most of what you're doing is it's interface design, it's copywriting, there's a lot more crossover. So the application projects I've done that have been successful have been ones where I've been involved in continuous collaboration with people who use cool designers right from the very start. And I found that that's actually that's an ongoing process that continues even after launch when feedback starts in. You start seeing how people are using it. You have to keep on evolving things. But it's left me with a real problem because while I can get my... I get to work with designers in sort of professional jobs, I have a whole bunch of personal projects for which I'm bereft. I have no design husband. So I currently find myself looking for my own Matt Jones, I suppose. So that's me.
All right, so we're 15 minutes in, we're still in the intro, so I'll make this quick. My name is Dave Shea, and by way of introduction, here's a couple of things that I currently do. It's a lot. Most of you, or some of you, might know me from my work on a site called csszengarden.com. I also run a website, a personal blog. Well, thank you. Hey. Yeah. I've got a personal blog, mezzoblue.com. I recently ran the second edition of a conference up in Vancouver where I live called Web Directions North. In amongst all this, I found some time to do a custom icon set, actually a few of them now. And, I do client work where I'm actually the designer on projects with various companies. It's contract by contract, and that's kind of how I work. Now, throughout all of this, the common thread, I suppose, is that I'm a designer, as you can tell by the black shirt and the Mac logo, I guess. But I'm a designer who happens to do some coding. Most of my tools are visual in nature. I use Photoshop, Illustrator. From time to time, I end up pulling up InDesign to do some print work, but I also have Coda and FTP programs and the command line in my arsenal. I'm finding that actually a very valuable combination for myself. Now, I'm also totally independent. I believe Simon is these days as well, but I'm probably unique on this panel in that I have absolutely no experience working in large companies. I've never worked for anything more than a handful of people, a dozen or so. However, I do end up going and working with clients who involve me in their process from start to finish, and I'm working very closely with them. So this is kind of what you think of, or what a lot of people think of as a design process. The client will come up with an idea, and they'll say, here's what I want to build. They'll hand it off to the designer, they'll go build it, and they'll hand something back. There's like a magic design box where everything happens. This is a little bit more like the reality. The client's going to have the idea, and I'm going to say, well, your idea actually sucks. Here's how to make it better. We're going to go back and forth. I'm going to present some mock-ups. The client's going to say, all right, this is what I like about them. This is what I don't like about them, how they meet the needs, how they don't meet the needs. They're going to suggest changes, which I may ignore, but they're going to suggest them anyway. And at the end of the day, I'm going to send back some templates, which can then be implemented by their developers, because I generally don't do that myself. Now, I said I code. I have the capability, but I try not to as much as I can. I try to leave that for them. So I end up getting in situations where I've got more people in the company that I'm dealing with. I'm collaborating with somebody on the design, and then I'm also working with somebody else on the code to implement those templates later on in the process. And I'm finding that in both cases, there's a lot of back and forth, there's a lot of give and take, and I end up getting stuck in the middle, and It's really kind of an interesting position to be in, because I do have clients right now that rely on me for an awful lot of stuff. They come to me to translate what the geeks are saying and translate it into human-friendly language so that they know what's going on with the developers. Sorry, I use the term geeks affectionately. If I offended anybody, I'm sorry, but it's like geeks and freaks, right? The freaks are the designers. So that's quickly me, and I'll pass it on to George.
Hi, everyone. Thank you. I've worked at Flickr since it was born. It's just turned 4 years old. And up until very recently, I was the lead designer on the team. My favorite way to work with the team is just drawing things on paper and sketching things out on whiteboards. I think it even gets down to the level of if somebody can see the direction that your hand is moving in when you draw a particular interaction that makes it clearer. And it's lo-fi, that's fine, it's lo-fi and easy to throw away, which is really cool. I just thought I might list down some of the roles that I've had when I have worked on the team. Right now, my job has transformed into what's called a program manager at Yahoo. I recently worked to release the Library of Congress pilot under the Flickr Commons project. So that will be my new... Thank you very much. So that's my new hat for this year. But a number of different roles on the Flickr team, most of which have been related to design in some form or another over the last 4 years. I'm also in the curious position of having watched the Flickr team grow and change over the last 4 years, subject to a fair few curious pressures that might not be exerted on many other teams, i.e. being acquired by an enormous company. So I've been really curious to watch and see what's happened to our development style. I just thought I'd note that when we first began in 2004, the core development team was only three people. It was myself and Cal Henderson and Eric Costello. And by core, I mean the people who had actual fingers in the code and were able to check things into our versioning system and deploy to the site. And over 4 years, it's grown to about 16. But it's also ballooned out into a number of different support staff areas, customer care, the ops team, stuff like that, just to support this enormous system that we've managed to build. Oh, I can do that now. We have well over 2.3 billion photos now on Flickr, and this still freaks me out. I can't quite believe how big it is. It blows my mind. We've got over 20 million people using Flickr now, and that's awesome. But I'm curious about its effect on the way we work, because in the early days at Flickr, we released early and we released often and would listen to the community for feedback. But now, as that's grown, the sort of feedback that we get has changed, and I'm curious about the effect of that on our development cycle. So hopefully I can maybe shed a bit of light on this panel about the sorts of things that do exert pressure over that gorgeous, romantic, small team that we all know and love who gets to work on killer web apps. Thank you.
Thanks, George. So now that we've all finished plugging our various products and telling you how awesome we are, I guess we should cut straight to the chase. The question that everyone wants to know the answer to, who would win in a fight, a developer or designer? Matt.
I think developers have the superpowers. I think they'd be building gigantic robots. Maybe the developer couldn't win by himself, but he or she would take them down with extra technical skills.
Okay. Dave?
I'm going to have to agree with Matt and say the developers would win because MacBooks have nice rounded edges, and if you've ever got hit with the edge of a hard plastic Linux laptop, it hurts like a bitch.
George?
Designers don't get involved in maths very much, and I think that's a good thing. When you're really good at maths, you're generally just so antisocial and nerdy that you don't know how to speak to anybody. So being able to communicate, you know, with a presence is something that designers have real skills in. And also we have to win lots of arguments about why we make decisions because we can't represent them empirically necessarily.
So in your experience, do you think that the designers actually do end up making the decisions on the project, on any project that you've worked on, or do you think it's the project manager? Do you think it tends to be the developer?
I think that everybody responds well to having an interface presented to them. And whether that be in the form of a prototype or something, you know, in Photoshop or on a whiteboard or something, I think that being able to talk around an interface is very useful whether you're a designer or a developer. And I think given that the designer's traditional skills are in presenting that sort of thing, it often leads that, you know, a designer can have influence that, you know, perhaps a developer wouldn't. But I think maybe the difference with web apps, at least, is that we're dealing with so much data, that sort of interface can come from either side, you know.
How does that work for you at Doppler, Matt?
Well, I guess the biggest advice I'd have for any developer-designer kind of connection is just the designers shouldn't be afraid of developers, and it's certainly the case at Doppler, I think, that the designers aren't afraid of us, although Tom Insom, I think, is pretty scary. But I'm fluffy and nice, so I keep him down. And there's, I think we work very closely together in iterating designs. I think one thing that you can end up with particularly data-driven sites is that initial designs sometimes miss edge cases and corner cases. And I think when in some of our earliest mock-ups of the Doppler UI, anyone who's got a whole bunch of people that they share trips with on Doppler will be used to this enormous quilt of icons at the bottom of the page. And that's because we sort of mocked up the page for people with 10 or so contacts. And I'd now got something in the, 500-ish. And actually, it's the list of my contacts is a lot longer than the list of my my trips on my page. And we didn't spot that because at that really early stage, we hadn't started going back and forth quickly between, oh, what if it looked this way? Okay, right, code up something that can make it work a little bit. Now, what if you turn that number to 100? Oh, that kind of breaks the design. We need a side case there.
If the question is who makes the decisions, isn't the answer whoever signs the paycheck? I generally find that because I'm collaborating a lot more with my clients directly, and there tends to be a mutual respect of my respect of their opinions and their ideas and their respect of the work that I'm doing, we both understand that decisions have to be made mutually and with reason. And if we're talking about things and we can't justify why they're happening, then they tend not to happen. And maybe I'm lucky in that, but that's the way I find it works a lot of the time, or at least works well.
So I think as a developer, the most frustrating thing that can happen to me is if I'm handed a spec and a sort of mock-up and told, build that. Because that's completely ignoring any sort of skills and knowledge I might have around, you know, using the web for the last 10 years. So I find it works much better if there's collaboration quite early on, if there's whiteboarding sessions. If there's collaboration between the two roles. I don't care what typeface you're using, but I do care like how many screens we're having and how the navigation between them happens. So if you don't leave me out, I'm perfectly happy.
As a bit of a counterpoint to that, actually, from a designer perspective, what's really annoying is, here's a site, just change the CSS and skin it, please.
Yeah, skin it for me.
Yeah, I've been guilty of that in the past.
So what can you do to make sure that the developers and designers both participate equally in the creative process that actually leads to that design, that plan for the site?
Well, make sure they're both involved very early on. I think Simon's onto something with the wireframing and whiteboarding. That's very helpful. Anytime I've had a project that does that, it seems to be more of a success.
I think sit in the same room. I mean, last year I did a lot of projects where I was working remotely, and the biggest frustration was that I couldn't tap someone on the shoulder, point them at the whiteboard, and sort out a problem right there on the spot. So this year I've been focusing very much on finding projects where I'm actually located in the same physical place.
Okay, cool. So on Friday, I went to the panel that Jeffrey Zeldman was chairing around respect. And Jason Santamaria said something I found really interesting, which was, he said, it's difficult for me to respect something I don't understand. So what can we do as developers and designers to help those that we work with understand what it is we're doing and the challenges that we're facing? George?
I think that has everything to do with how the design is put together. If you have members from all of the disciplines collaborating at that early stage and actually coming up with the design together, mm-hmm. and agreeing on what it will be, I think the job's done. It's when you have the sort of top-down stuff that Simon was talking about, where you get that breakdown about, you know, even criticism of the design, or, you know, questions about how it works and stuff. If everybody's in the same room having the same conversation, I think you can get a lot of that stuff just out the way because people are all agreeing at the time, you know.
Dave, how do you manage to cope with that when you're coming into a company from the outside and they don't necessarily understand the way that you work?
Well, I mean, I have a bit of an easier time of it because as a designer, I can just point to things and say, that's what I did. There's obviously a little more nuance than that, but I don't have code that's buried and I have to show and explain and have this interpretation layer so that they know what I'm doing. I show past examples. I say, this is how I've worked before. This is what the result was. And if I have to go in detail, I can say, these are the steps we went through to get to that point. That cuts through it a lot of the time if they can just have something to grasp onto and see that.
Mm. I think prototyping is really useful there. Just, you know, bare bones HTML something or other that works with live data, because I think that speaks to both, you know, mindsets, both sides of the brain, if you like. Both parties. I'm setting this up as very oppositional. I don't mean to do that. But if anyone on the team can see a prototype actually working, I think that also speaks volumes much more than a static, you know, Photoshop document can do.
That's something I found very useful in my sort of freelancing and consulting, is if I knock up a quick prototype of something, it sort of plays to the fact that developers know what's possible more than designers in many respects, which is why I think it's so important to let developers stick their oar in.
And that can be a source of that kind of mystique, of that sort of fear of developers. It's like, oh, right, what if I suggest something? They laugh because it's not possible with computers.
Actually, one of my favourite people to collaborate with on the Flickr team is our crazy Russian database genius called Sergei Morishov, because he has an amazing big picture perspective over our enormous data set, and he can do really weird shit, sort of, you know, running huge processes over all the photos and coming up with something, you know, and showing this sort of, you know, search results page that he's been able to generate, just thinking in sort of crazy directions is just hugely inspirational, because it gives me a view of the data that I wouldn't have conceived of myself, you know, from a deeply technical standpoint.
I'm kind of curious, for those of you coming from the larger company backgrounds, when you build these prototypes early on in the process, how are designers involved in that, or is that specifically a developer thing that you then hand to the designer and say, okay, now you can build on top of this? How does that work?
It sort of depends on the skill set of the person on the actual team. Like, most of the people on our in the Flickr team can sort of cross-pollinate between roles. We have a few people who are sort of specialist client-side developers, so they can mock up the prototypes very quickly. But certainly it's like, you know, there'll be two people over their shoulder sort of looking at those things, and they might be a designer and a developer, or they might be two developers, or they might be, you know, even a customer care person, if we've been thinking about some improvements to the help system, and you know, that's the right person to be looking at that prototype, you know.
But it seems to me that Flickr's in a particularly good position for having a prototyping culture, because the Flickr API is sort of rich to the point that pretty much any feature on the site can be replicated through it.
Yeah.
So anyone can just build against that.
Right. That's actually how we rolled out the Places feature. Dan and I worked together on getting a sort of a roughshod design together, and then he just used the public-facing API to put a prototype together, and it was great. I mean, we had to go through a process of actually sort of translating his woolly code into sort of production-ready stuff, because he was making heaps of calls to various, you know, would have put a huge load on the site if we'd gone live with it, but it was a really useful process to see, you know, the sort of crunching he could do with live data in a prototype form.
So you mentioned job roles. On my way over to the conference, I realized that everyone on this panel is a generalist. We all wear many hats at different stages of project. Do you think that's an important part of being able to work together as a team? Do you think people need to be multi-talented, or did I just pick a really unrepresentative panel?
In my experience, the projects I've worked on that have been the most successful have involved small teams of generalists. And in particular, the best experience I've had working with designers, designers like Dave, who can roll HTML and CSS, because it's kind of like being a sculptor who understands how carving stone works. You know what's possible within your medium, then you can do much more realistic design work. But again, that's just in my experience.
I think it's very important to have specialists or specialist knowledge. I think that the shared thing that's very important, at least in our work, is a shared understanding of the product, like the thing that you're trying to make. And some of the discussions, chatting with George a while back about the voice of your product, is something that's really important for everyone to understand. And I mean, that actually comes right down to copy. There's stuff that we write. The Doppler's quite a word-heavy UI, and several of us, whether the business people or me or Matt, we could write a sentence that is in the Doppler voice, and it fits into the interface. And that helps you think about features as well when you're exploring either what's possible in data or what's possible in an interaction, is to go, is that a feature Doppler would do? Or is it not? And you sort of test it against the personality of the product, and that's the shared understanding I think is really useful.
Mm. That's another point. Sorry, Dave. Another point where developers, I think, can have insight that's useful to a designer. I found it profoundly useful to work with developers who can see the gotchas and see the weird little error cases that you might not be able to account for, and they all need to have copy written for them, because, you know, you need to help somebody come back out of an error when they hit a wall. And, you know, I might catch 5 or 6, but there might be 1 or 2 more that I wouldn't have thought of. And I think that sort of insight from a developer, because they know, you know, what the system needs to account for, is something that is hugely beneficial.
Yeah, I mean, knowing a little something about server-side code and databases, I'm finding constantly in my design work, I'm coming up with ideas and saying, no, that's actually not practical, because that doesn't really work with data that's dynamic or coming out of a database constantly. And, you know, that's the entire point of the site, so I can't really do it that way. I have to figure out some other way. And this has traditionally been a big problem with print designers transitioning to the web, is they don't quite understand that you don't have a fixed canvas. You've got stuff that's going to go all over the place. You've got content that will be dynamic and changing all the time. And just understanding, you know, that is a critical first step. But, you know, I'm taking it further these days, and being, like I said earlier, that kind of interpretation layer between what's happening in the code and sometimes other members of the team or the client. And I'm finding that as an independent, that works out really well for me. So if you're an independent, I'd say generalize. And if you're looking for one, look for a generalist. That's my advice.
So along the lines of designers not necessarily knowing what's technically possible, there's a trend in the industry towards separating the role of, for want of a better term, client-side developer from the role of visual designer and interaction designer. Do you see this as being a good thing? Or who wants to take that, Simon?
I can. So I've already said that the best designers I've worked with have been client-side developers as well. But at the same time, I think client-side development is possibly the hardest of all of the roles within web development these days. I mean, it's you're writing code that has to run against, what, 5 rendering engines these days. Now, there's
don't even think about mobile.
Yeah, yeah, don't even think about that. But now there's 3 versions of IE that you need to care about. So while it would be great if all designers were also elite CSS and HTML hackers, it's just not plausible. You can't expect that of people when there's so much that you need to learn in that sphere. There's also, I think, client-side developers is starting to encompass JavaScript as well, which is an interesting skill because it's something that's it's a real programming language. So it's something that server-side developers find it easier to come to than designers. I like it if people can do all of these things, but realistically, I think that divide is something that needs to happen.
Dave?
Yeah, what he said.
Fair enough.
Yeah, I found myself. I mean, I've always been a real like server side developer, and until pretty recently, I went away from web work for a long time. I did a lot of infrastructure stuff. I even got paid to do something in Second Life once. But I come back to the web because the tools and to handle all these kind of browser things have come back to being good enough that I can tinker in front-end stuff, and I find the insight that gives me when I'm making something that I'm not just working in the data, but working partly in the interface, it helps me understand the flows that are going into the design.
Actually, I think it's more relaxing to know who you're working with and what they're specifically involved in to do. You know, mm-hmm. being able to rely on members in your team to have specific areas of functionality that you know they're responsible for, I think is really important. You know, if we're all fluffy and cross-pollinating and stuff, I think that's when you get a bit woolly on the decisions and, you know, who's responsible for what.
But that doesn't scale down to teams of 3 people. I mean, it seems like that's definitely relevant when you've got sort of 13.
Mm-hmm.
But Flickr does have only 3 people working on most individual features. So.
Yeah, but even so, I mean, I think with 3 people, the roles are still pretty clear, at least the way we work. We generally sort of have somebody who's doing the layout and the copy, etc., who may or may not be the same person as who builds the HTML and CSS and stuff, who may or may not be the same person as the one who builds the server-side connection stuff. You know, it could be the same person, but often it's 3 different people. But just being clear about who's doing what, I think, is really important.
So how much overlap do you think is healthy in those relationships? Do you think it...
Don't know. Depends on the person.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right. What should I say? So someone, a close friend of mine, once said something along the lines of process is an antidote to stupid people. The idea here is that you only need process to make sure that the bad people who work on your product don't make the same mistakes that they made last time, and by putting a process in place, you're magically going to make everything better. Do you think that is a fair assessment of the best way to work together as teams, that attitude?
I don't know if I'd use the word stupid, but I certainly agree with the sentiment. In the proposals that I write, which actually are structured to be almost contracts, really, they very specifically set out the steps along the way of the design process and how we get from point A to point B. And what I find is that when I hand it to a new client, it's laid out very clearly, but I say, listen, we're not really going to follow that. The design process is a lot more organic. We're not going to, you know, stick to that 3 rounds of feedback that you give me on each one of the deliverables that I've got codified. Unless I feel that it's taking more time and you're just being too hard to work with, which I don't say, then we'll go back, and that's the fallback position. So I've got that accounted for. So I think my default state is to say, I trust that you're going to be a better person to work with, but if you're not, then I think process is what's going to save me.
How does that work for you, Matt?
I definitely think I ran away from process and big companies and stuff. When I left the BBC, I had a strong feeling I never wanted to work again for a big company. And by big, I mean maybe 12 people, something like that. There were so many things you couldn't sort of trust to be there just because of the sort of... It's not so much process always as the way that resources are allocated. If people can be resources when you're doing a project, then you're already in a strange situation. And I kind of, you know, for a long time I wanted process to work. years ago, I started reading the literature on project management and realized how many bad project managers I had had, who didn't appear to actually have the same background in their discipline that the people around doing the build had in theirs. But actually, in the end, I gave up and I ran away. And now I just like being able to pick the people that I work with people who are incredibly good at what they do. And I have so much respect for people who try and solve the problem with process, because I guess we've got to do big projects somewhere in the world. Dams have to be built. But I gave up.
I don't know. I think humans in general don't respond very well to anarchy. And I think there's sort of a revulsion against process, because we've probably all worked on the sort of waterfall style checkpoints and gates and approvals sort of stuff, and that can get pretty bland pretty quickly. But I think it's still useful. I enjoy having sort of touch points in the way people work together that, it's good to hit.
It's good to have something to measure yourself along the way.
Right.
I mean, we may ship little bits of feature or little bug fixes every day, several times a day, but we still also have a monthly release. And even if it's only that all the features are already live by the time release day comes along, but on release day we blog about them and go, hey, look, we got a bunch of new features. And most people might, a lot of people might not have noticed those new features. And we go, cool, we hit the Austin release. We got the Austin features out in time to be sitting on a stage talking about them.
Right. Yeah, we like kicking goals and, feeling like we're actually being productive and achieving things, I think. And having release goals or something like that, I think, is useful to keep everybody on track. But I think the trouble comes when you start to load a process with a variety of different inputs that don't get the product built any faster. I think one of the pressures that the Flickr team has exerted on it now is the fact that we release the site in 8 different languages. So any feature development that we do now has to be translated into all those languages. And I think that makes it more difficult for us to make mistakes, because we need to have things, robust enough that we won't have to go back through too many translation cycles. And I think that's actually affected our ability to release early and release often. But on the flip side, it's fantastic that we can deploy things to 8 different languages. So that's an example of some sort of process pressure that isn't necessarily about the development itself, but changes the way we work.
Of course, if you want to know more about the internationalization of Flickr, then you can hear our colleague Simon talking about it in this room in hour's time. I'm going to ask a handful more questions, and then we're going to open it up to you to ask questions, or maybe if you've got some observations about things that work really well for you, then we'd like to hear them. So if you want to start lining up at the mics while we finish off this, then that'd be great. I've got one more question, which is, how can I, as a developer, make myself easier to work with to designers? George, maybe? Maybe you could deconstruct me as a developer live on stage.
Well, I think the main difference between websites and web applications is the fact that we're working with an organic information system that stretches and moves and snaps and, and I think it's very important for web designers transitioning into building applications to have an understanding of that. What does a page look like when there's zero interaction? Designing for that blank slate, zero data sort of thing. And I think developers have insight into the data structures and, tables in a database and fields and the sorts of fields they are and all that sort of thing that I wouldn't necessarily know about. And I think being able to educate designers about the data constraints is really important now that we're working with live data that moves all the time.
Matt, what about designers? How can they make themselves easy to work with from your perspective?
Show you're working, basically. I think something that we that works well within our we're all kind of have philosophical pretensions about our deep disciplines, and it's something that Matt and Boris do very well is explain the models in their thinking. It's like, okay, these pixels are there for this reason, or these things are hyperlinks and these aren't, because that's the model that we're trying to sort of subliminally impress onto people who use it that we think will be intuitive. And I find that getting that insight into the design and knowing why things are there, because I have no sort of formal design training or background, really helps me when I need to improvise a bit of page. So it's, okay, I'm building something, there wasn't an actual mock-up made for it. Following the rules and the model behind the design I'm implementing, what should this bit of the page do and how should it look? And often I can get away with just filling something in there that saves us a lot of time as a team.
I think the best thing that I've ever done to help myself be understood better by developers is learning SVN.
So there was a really good panel a few days ago by a couple of the people on the design team at Clear Left about how they've started building HTML prototypes to communicate to development teams what they need to build. And the neat thing, and this is another thing of having designers who can do HTML and CSS, but a neat thing they were doing is embedding hidden notes in the page, explaining this should look like this when this user hasn't signed up yet, this is what this should do. So lots and lots of little annotations on that design. And then they have a little link at the top of the page which you can click to show or hide those notes. So I thought that was a really interesting sort of idea for improving that communication process.
And lastly, how can server-side developers and client-side developers communicate better? What do you think, Simon?
Yes, Simon.
How can they communicate better? This is one of the few things where I think the technology can save us. I've done a lot of work with templating languages. In particular, Django has a template language that's designed to be very easy for front-end developers to understand. And if you do that, it means that your server-side developers can knock out deliberately ugly templates with terrible HTML. I find that really helps. You hand them over to the client-side guys, and they'll be so horrified that they'll actually want to dive in, edit the templates, and fix things up. But I found the counter of that is every time you... I've seen projects where the sort of client-side developers build all the HTML and JavaScript and CSS, and they hand it off to the server-side developers to implement, and it gets completely butchered, and that results in really angry, frustrated client-side developers. So I think having some kind of templating mechanism where client-side developers can actually do their thing and make real changes is really important for keeping that harmony between the two factions.
I think the biggest thing that I've come across is that abstractions are a little too tough to talk about at the beginning. You have to have something concrete to base your conversations around. So even if it's as simple as wireframes, could be as complex as mockups later on in the process, but somewhere along the way, you have to be looking at something together and pointing and saying, that's what I'm talking about right now. And that just seems to help facilitate conversation much better.
I've just had a text informing me that the best way for us to communicate is by drinking more beer. What do you think?
I am down with that.
Amen.
That's why we're here.
Fantastic. Okay, we're going to take questions from the floor now. We'll start on the left.
Hi there, my name is Greg Baskin. I represent offshore developers in South Africa. And I'm currently working for a company that's 15 years old, still in startup. And they have very complex technology. And one thing that they do very well is change management in a change request system. The problem with that is in rapid application development or Scrum-type situations, it's overhead that you don't have time for. So I think what Mr. Wilson said about the technology will save us, I think agile change management and change request systems, which allow all of us as developers and designers, and many of us, I think, are both Jekyll and Hyde, right? And we have input in both areas. If there was a system that would allow us to quickly make suggestions and get credit for them, appeal decisions made about them, etc., do you have any tools that you guys use like that?
So one of the first things I introduce to companies that don't have one already these days is a simple ticketing system. My preference is Track, but there are loads of things out there. So, but they're often called bug trackers, which is incredibly misleading because they're not about tracking bugs. They're about tracking sort of bugs and design decisions and things that need to be changed. And I find that they're... especially the really lightweight tools, very easy for people to get into, can completely transform small teams that haven't been doing that. Although, of course, that speaks to teams that haven't been doing that already.
I think the problem for me in particular, being an independent and working on contract by contract, is that the overhead for setting something like that up has kind of prevented me from doing it all along. So, I mean, this is a problem for me as well, and something where, you know, change requests go into my inbox, and there they sit for a long, long time. And if there were lightweight tools to do that, that would allow multiple projects again and again and again, and maybe there are tons out there that I don't know of. But
there are hosted applications that can do that kind of stuff now.
We'll have to talk after.
Yeah.
We'll go to the right next.
Hi, I'm Mike Prasad. I'm the, architect for GrowGamer.com. And we have a really small team. We're basically startup self-funded, and we have an awesome web designer, genius guy, and we have an awesome developer. We are running into problems where our developer is this great programmer, and our designer does CSS and does HTML, and they're not communicating and they're not bridging the gap. So when developers implement the actual HTML CSS structures into a dynamic code and into a dynamic page, he needs tweaks, he needs adjustments. The CSS guy will assume that his structure is so good that he will not kind of fine-tune it with the developer. And the developer doesn't know CSS, or can't seem to implement it right. So, I mean, they're really genius in what they do individually, but there's like this gap in the middle where you're integrating them together. And what I thought was maybe trying to find someone who can kind of bridge that gap, a third person that would do kind of like it, helping the CSS integrate, tweak the CSS with the PHP, and so on and so forth. And we've yet to find someone like that. If anyone actually was interested, email me at mike@girlgamer.com. But my question to you guys is really, do you guys find a setup of a 3 to 5 or small team setup that you find is really effective in terms of roles?
To me, that sounds a little bit more like a cultural issue than the way you set up your team. I mean, firstly, if your developer thinks he's so fantastic that nothing could ever be wrong, you need to have a bit of a chat with him about it. But secondly, I think... rather than having, you know, an endpoint in mind where you think something will be done, if you approach projects as if they're in a perpetual state of design, I think that might be useful. So, you know, the developer's aware that there will be a feedback cycle that goes back to the designer. And, you know, you might release it to the community and then there'll be more design and there'll be more changes and there'll be more tweaks, you know. You know, the idea that something is not necessarily concrete ever, I think, is a really liberating way to work, you know, because it allows you to feel as if you can change something. And I think that's probably good for your developer, but also good for your designer to approach. I don't know. What do you guys think about that?
Well, in the situation just described, that's exactly what I was talking about with regards to templating systems and making sure that there's a clean technical divide between those two areas so it's safe for your client-side development guy to actually edit files and change things and go ahead like that. So I'd advocate using something like Smarty for PHP encouraging them to actually both get dirty in the code without bothering each other's bits and pieces.
Yeah, and we end up working in the same files between the client side and server side developer stuff, I think. But also that where we sometimes in our specific case fall down is that although we have a very kind of agile deployment system, we have the sort of mythical one command deploy to live. There's only the two server side developers are kind of have the magic keys to do that. We haven't sort of loosened up to the extent that the there's a sort of perfect balance of power between those sides, and I think that can lead to a sense that, like, right, the server-side guys have to check it before it's allowed to go on the server. We don't want that to be the case. We want it to be that there's an absolute balanced relationship because we do really trust each other as professionals.
Cool. Thank you. Hi, my name is Jesse Gardner. I am, much like Dave Che, I'm a freelance designer, plastic bind design, and I have to preface this by saying that I'm a designer, so that kind of frames the question here. But I found it interesting you guys were talking about prototypes, and as I was functioning as a design husband at one point in time, working in a team, we actually presented to a fairly large company. We presented a prototype that was really loose from a design standpoint, and I found that actually was really hard for the client. It was really distracting, and they actually, you know, they were so caught up with it not looking right that that they actually, you know, that they actually didn't think we had gotten as far as we had. And I don't know if you guys comment on that. Do you think it just depends on the type of client that you're working with, or, you know, what's the interplay there?
Yeah, I think that probably comes down to client education and making sure that they understand you're talking about the functionality. I mean, I hate to say this, but I've actually built out prototypes with wireframes that I built in the past just for the sake of having something. And to me, that can potentially be a waste of time, or at least my time, when, you know, we're trying to go toward a final design. It's not a bad thing to have, but you know, the wireframes, at least from my perspective, should be something that not something that exists only in static form. But if you're going to be going as far as implementing it in HTML, CSS, it's probably gone much beyond a wireframe at that point, and you're actually working on a prototype. So, yeah, in relation to your question, I think client education is really it, and just having savvy clients, and or if they're not, making sure that they get it.
I think there's also a massive risk involved in doing prototypes that look beautiful, because you'll show it to them and they'll say, brilliant, go live! And you'll be like, well, no, there's another sort of 4 months of actual building the real thing to go. So I know there's a school of thought that the design quality of your prototype should reflect how finished it is. And I think there are even special typefaces you can get that look like scruffy handwriting, which you can use to really try and drive home the point that this is not done yet.
It does sort of come down. I think there's the key difference. One of the key differences here in the landscapes that we're working in is the difference between working on an ongoing project, something like Flickr or Doppler, where there is a look and feel in place, and you can sort of you can set up a construction site within that look and feel, and we actually take care to put a CSS class on most of the sort of experimental features so that they may either look uglier, or at least we know this is explicitly, these are not finished. Don't assume that this is going to go live. And then we're working with a partner company to set up some integration with some of their data. And we did get some, I sent them an email going, here's a proof of concept to show that we are reading the data from your API. And they started sending back design comments because they saw their data in our look and feel. And I just used our default classes, whereas we're supposed to make it look a bit like their look. And that's when you suddenly realize that, like, okay, we have a really good shared understanding in this ongoing endeavor of making this single product, as opposed to, I was a freelancer once, and I remember that, over and over again, the client education, the kind of, okay, this is how we're going to work, and doing your best to set up sort of standards and norms, but you don't always get that freedom or that understanding. Mm.
I think a lot of people forget with the agile development process, you know, that rapid iterative stuff, it actually relies very heavily on having a client present with you to do the work. You know, I think it relates back to what we were sort of saying before about getting a shared understanding of what you're about to build, you know, and having, when you're doing client work, I think having the client present in a lot of those preliminary discussions and, you know, working out what's going to be done is crucial, so they're not surprised when they see a prototype or a mock at a certain fidelity.
Thanks. Yeah, I'm a designer, and I don't know any code at all. But I like front-end guys a lot. I really believe in what you're saying about the sculpting and the whiteboard discussions ahead of time and, like, little sketches and things like that between them. And we do a lot of that. What I'm trying to perfect is the best way when there is that time where you have to hand things off and I can't, you know, code it poorly and have them fix it or anything like that. I have to hand off comps, and there's a huge spectrum between, like, this is the comp and this is kind of how it looks, as opposed to this is every single page and these are the measurements and this is what's an image and this what isn't. I mean, that can be like a week or it can be an afternoon, and I just wondered in your experience where do you draw the line and how detailed it is when you hand it off?
Dave, you're probably best placed to answer that.
So the question is, when you actually hand it off for implementation at the end, or when you pass it off to the client for first preview?
No, when everything's been approved, everything's ready to go, and it's going to the front end guy.
Like, okay.
How far do you take that, as opposed to just have him build it and then fix things after it's built?
Yeah, I'm not sure that I can necessarily answer that, because I do end up doing the building myself. Yeah. I. I find that, okay, if I separate myself out into two different roles, during the actual development, things come up that I didn't account for in my original design. I mean, if you have the luxury of having, you know, everything wireframed out at the start, from top to bottom, and nothing changes throughout the design process, then I want your job. But I find it's a lot more organic. Things will come up. I have to deal with change along the way. And so sometimes I'll be addressing that change in the CSS and go, wait. Okay, this is a design problem. I need to step back. I need to go back to Photoshop and come back and do it again. So I like to have it as complete as possible before I start the front-end coding, because major structural changes down the road are just a huge pain. Yeah. But little things will come up, and so I have to recognize that and make sure there's ability to do that extra little bit of design work when need be.
So with my client-side development hat on, one thing that I do really like from designers who aren't doing any code at all is if they slice the images up for me in Photoshop. Because actually, one thing that really helps with is it shows that they've thought about how this is all going to work. Sure. If they've sliced up the images, then you know that this image is going to be the repeating background down and this image is meant to overlay there. So I think that's and if you can learn how to do that, even if you don't know HTML and CSS, if you know how to slice up images to the point where they'd be usable by your client-side developer, that makes me very happy.
There was a never-ending argument when I worked at the BBC as to who should slice up the images. And I'd always assumed it was just sheer laziness on everyone's part.
So I don't have Photoshop, so it kind of forces the argument for me.
Yeah, we just bought our guy CS3, so...
Thanks.
Okay. I think you raise an interesting point with that question, though, of this point where in every project something needs to be handed off to someone else. I think Matt's given us some good examples where he's actually initiated a project and it hasn't had any particular design made on it at all. You know, the idea that the team is collaborating constantly and it's not that you need to have everything accounted for in a design and then pass it to the developer, I think is maybe the idea that we're trying to get across. You know, that I could see some of Matt's working code and then I could not just put spit and polish on it, but, you know, enhance it, hopefully, with some feedback and stuff. But, you know, I think we need to sort of try and move away from the idea that the designer is the person who lays out the whole system, you know. It's got to be about coming from both directions, I think.
I think we've only got time for one more question, so I'm going to go to the left.
I'm an independent consultant, so I work with lots of different clients. How do you deal with the situation where you have maybe less interested or junior people that often feel very out of their depth when they're sort of in prototyping sessions, where they're looking at lots of different things and they're maybe just being taught or are just interested in one thing?
Who wants to answer that?
Give them something to do.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, I think mentoring is an incredibly important thing, and that, you know, that feeds into any company culture or project culture. You know, give people responsibilities that are big, but that you have a backup plan for when they fail. Recognize who likes to talk and who likes to sit back and watch. It's a general people issue, I think. And it's going to be the same for any new, whether junior or not, any team that's working well probably has a strong culture, and kind of getting thrown into that on the first day is always going to be tough. So it's mentoring and introducing people in careful ways, I guess, is the answer.
One of the things I know that the dev team on Flickr does when we have a new person join us is have them familiarize themselves with the API and maybe even build something. You know, just be sure that they know how the system works.
With Flickr, though, how often is it that someone coming in as a junior member of staff is their first job?
Not very often.
We had one recently.
Yeah.
I think the question is more how do we... particularly junior developers can often be very scared when they're thrown into a brainstorming session, when they're thrown into a whiteboarding session in a room and asked to comment on designs, particularly when they're mixed in with very experienced senior design people. How can you kind of make that easier for them?
Well, I guess they'll only stop being scared once they've done it a few times, you know. I mean, you don't have to baptize them with fire, but, you know, it's great for them to realize that they can have some responsibility in a project too. And, you know, maybe the first few ideas they have aren't as strong as they might be later, but that's no reason not to have them involved. I mean, you know, you obviously hired them because they're not crap, so... test them, you know.
We're going to be around at the front of the stage for a few minutes after this session, so if anyone has any more questions or comments, then feel free to come up and talk to us. And thank you very much for listening.
Thank you.
Thank you.